Shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico. It's the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN with your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Welcome to this week's edition of Nocturnal Journal. Thank you for Neil Diamond there. And we're going to go start the segment by going to Bronzeville, Hyde Park, and Chatham with the three finalists. Are they finalists? Are they winners of the Chicago August Wilson Monologue Competition?
They're winners.
They're winners. And this is Derek Sanders, the executive director of the Chicago August Wilson Monologue Competition. This is the sixth annual.
Yes, sir.
And tell me how this started and why it started and where it started.
Well, about 10 years ago, August Wilson passed, and I know Todd Crowell and Kenny Leon, who are friends of mine, and they started it out at True Colors as a kind of pilot program. And they would say, Derek, you got to get involved. We got to get Chicago involved. And I was looking for an opportunity in a way to get students involved and experience August Wilson as I have experienced him, and through his words, through the power of his words, the power of his characters. So this monologue competition was born, and I decided to partner with the League of Chicago Theaters, Goodman Theater, and University of Illinois Chicago, and create this monologue competition in Chicago. And basically we have students come from as far as St. Louis to audition. This year we had over 700 students audition, and those got knocked down to 60. The 60 got knocked down to 20. They performed at the Goodman Theater, and these are the top three finalists that will be performing on the August Wilson stage on Broadway in May.
That's amazing. So is it like regionals? I mean, is this in other parts of the country?
You said people from absolutely. St. Louis came regions are Atlanta, New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, Portland, Pittsburgh, just to name a few.
And we're going to have some readings here in a little bit, but what's the criteria? How are the students judged?
You just got to be a high school student and pick a monologue and show up to the auditions. It's free of charge, you know. With my sponsors, Community Trust, allows us to be able to make it free for the kids.
Is there a, delivery? I mean, are there certain areas in how they judge? I mean, delivery, content?
Absolutely, absolutely. Character, vocal delivery, style and projection. Those basic acting things, like how you present the monologue, how you present August's words is our top criteria. And we get some of the more famous actresses and actors and theater luminaries to judge these students at the finals at the Goodman.
In doing my research, is this true? Chicago's the only city to have finalists in the top three at the national finals every year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. That's really,
yeah.
really good. Why is that?
Amazing,
why, yeah, tell
we got some amazing talent in Chicago. I mean, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to also do it is because I think Chicago youth get a bad rap.
Right.
You know, they get a bad rap because of all the violence that happened. But it's a lot of positive things happening in Chicago, a lot of talent. Out of all the years that we've drawn, we've placed every year, and we're the only city that's ever done that.
That's why I wanted to do this segment. We'll open it up to the students. Everybody thinks about this. I mean, there's so many distractions, so many options, so many things for you guys to do. Tell us about your pathway into this and how you chose to do this. We can. Casey?
Yeah.
This is Casey Edwards.
Hi.
Hi, Casey. You look a little like Starlin Castro at the Cubs game there. Anyway, go ahead.
Repeat the question, please.
Oh, just, I mean, there's music, you know, there's sports. I mean, all the different things you can get involved in, mm-hmm. you know, stuff on the street and stuff. I mean, what made you decide, how'd you follow this? How'd you find it?
Well, there's definitely been, like, a lot of, you know, chances for me to get into those other things. You know, I've tried other things in my life, but really, when it just comes down to it, there's only been, you know, one thing, acting, theater, that's, like, really just made me happy, that I've like truly enjoyed. And it's funny, I've actually been asked this question a lot recently, like, but when I think about like everything else that I could be doing and like all the things that I want to do with my life, nothing really appeals to me more than like just pursuing mm-hmm. this and like just, you know, bringing stories to life, bringing characters to life for people, and just being able to be that for people is really just rewarding in so many ways.
For all of you, following up with you, what have you learned about yourself? What's something you learned that you didn't know about yourself by doing this?
Well, something right off the bat that I think of, when I first, you know, got into, you know, theater and like acting, you know, it was usually because, like, you know, when I thought about being in a movie, the thing that appealed to me at first was just like, oh, I want to be that funny comic relief in a movie that people love to watch and stuff. And my mom, whenever I would say that, she wouldn't really like hearing that I wanted to settle for comic relief. But that's really all I ever thought that I could be. And then, you know, getting more into acting and growing more as an actor, you know, one of the things I've realized about myself is, like, I do have the potential to be, like, the main character, the lead, to do more serious dramatic things, as I've done in this August Wilson monologue. And, you know, it's really a great feeling to be able to take, you know, I'm so passionate about acting, and to see myself be more serious about it and, like, be able to impact people more, mm-hmm. you know, that's cool.
How old are you?
I'm 18.
18?
Yeah.
You want to read something now? Are you ready to read something?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I have a jitney booster.
Yeah.
Tell us give us a little setup, what this is. And
okay.
Why you chose it.
Okay. Well, when looking at the list of monologues from August Wilson's plays, a lot, you know, they're all really good. All the, you know, male pieces, really, really good. But when I got to this one, I don't know, there was something in it that clicked for me, because it's a piece where Booster, he's talking to his father, and he's trying to justify his actions, an action that he's done, something that he's done his father doesn't really, you know, look well on. And he's trying to justify his actions and prove to his father that, you know, the things he's done for a good reason. And he's a better man for it. And he doesn't, you know, regret what he's done. He did it for a reason. And he is certain that it is what he needed to do. Mm-hmm. And that stuck out to me because, you know, my relationship with my father is good. But, you know, thinking like, you know, thinking if my dad were to, you know, not, you know, to resent something that I've done, you know, in his name, you know, what that would feel like. And this was just a good, you know, way to get into that.
Can we hear some of it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Pop. You taught me a lot of things. And a lot of things I had to learn on my own. Like that time Mr. Rand came to the house to collect the rent when we was 2 months behind. I don't remember what year it was. I just know it was winter. Grandma Ada had just died, and you got behind on the rent because you had to help pay for her funeral. I don't know if you knew it, Pop, but you were a big man. Everywhere you went, people treated you like a big man. You used to take me to the barbershop with you. You'd walk in there and fill up the whole place. Everybody would stop cussing because Jim Becker had walked in. And I would just look at you and wonder how you could be that big. And I wanted to be like that. You know, I would go to school and try to make myself feel big, but I never could. I told myself, that's okay. When I get grown, I'm going to be big like that. Walk into a barbershop and have everybody stop and look at me. That day, Mr. Rand came to the house. It was snowing, and you came out on the porch, and he started shouting and cussing and threatening to put us out on the street where we belonged. And I was waiting for you to tell him to shut up. To get off your porch. But you just looked at him and promised you'd have the money next month. Mama came to the door and Mr. Rand kept shouting and cussing. And I looked at Mama and she was trying to get me to go back into the house. And I looked at you and you had got smaller. The longer he shouted, the smaller you got. When we went back to the barbershop, you didn't seem so big no more. He was the same size as everybody else. He was just another man in the barbershop, and that is when I told myself that if I ever let myself get big, I wasn't going to let nothing make me small. And then when I met Susan McKnight and found out her daddy was the vice president of Gulf Oil, that's when I got big. That made me a big man. I felt like I could be somebody, like I could walk into a barbershop and fill it up the way you did. And then when she told that lie on me,
That's when I woke up. That's when I realized that I wasn't big on my own, that I wasn't big on the inside. When she told that lie on me, it made me small. And I wanted to do something that said that I wasn't just another Negro, that I was Clarence Becker. I wanted to make them remember my name. And then I thought about you standing there and getting small, and Mr. Rand shouting and Susan McKnight shouting at that lie, and I realized it was my chance to make the Beckers big again, my chance to show what I had learned on my own. I thought you would understand. I thought you'd be proud of me. Thank you.
Wow. Wow. You got a nice, look at that. You got a nice crowd.
Oh,
nice crowd out there.
You're looking outside.
That's
thank you.
Man, I tell you, there's no fear in that. That was really, really,
thanks,
really tremendous. We're going to take
thank
a break
you
for the news, and then we're going to come back with Lauren Carter. For the commercials. I'm sorry. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal, and we're here with the Chicago August Wilson Monologue Competition winners, and I know August Wilson was a fan of Bessie Smith, which we heard a little bit of there. Do you hear rhythms? Do you hear a cadence in his words?
Yes, definitely.
Lauren, both of you guys, Lauren and Booker, expand on that.
When we had like rehearsals and everybody was talking about doing their monologues, they everybody had like a pattern of how they wanted to say their monologue. It was always like, okay, I'm gonna do a beat here. Where it wasn't like a planned beat. It was just like, okay, I feel it right here. It's like his monologues, they speak to you, and you know exactly when you should feel a specific emotion because you can sort of make a connection to it. So it's like it breaks all the feeling. It breaks beats into it when you perform your monologues.
Can you guys equate that with music today? I mean, can you bring it up to music you hear today, or is it just a separate?
You can definitely bring his monologues into like today's life. Yeah,
yeah.
We saw two trains running not too long ago, and everything that they were talking about in that play was relevant to today's society.
Now I'm worried about the time a little bit. But you're gonna read the piano lesson.
Yeah, Bernice? A monologue from the piano.
Yeah,
lesson,
and yeah, again, set it up. Tell me why you picked it.
Okay, I actually didn't pick this monologue. We didn't get a chance to pick our monologues. Our teachers did it for us, and I think that was the best decision because I wouldn't have picked this monologue that I received. But the piano lesson is about a piano that's significant to this family in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And the piano means a lot to them because it was given to them, I think, from their slave owner, if I'm getting this right. I don't want to say anything that's incorrect. And Bernice's brother, Boy Willie, wants to sell the piano to get his land back, but she holds his piano dear to her, and she wants to keep it. So,
okay.
Okay. My name is Laura, and I'll be doing a monologue from the piano lesson. I done told you I don't play on that piano. Ain't no needing you to keep talking, it's choir stuff. When my mama died, I shut the top on that piano and I ain't never opened it since. I was only playing it for her. When my daddy died, seemed like all her life went into that piano. She used to have me playing it. Have Miss Eula come in and teach me, say when I played it, she could hear my daddy talking to her. I used to think them pictures came alive and walked through the house. Sometime late at night, I could hear my mama talking to him. I said, that wasn't going to happen to me. I don't play on that piano because I don't want to wake them spirits. They'll never be walking around in this house. I got Maritha playing on it. She don't know nothing about it. Let her go on and be a school teacher or something. She don't have to carry all that with her. She got a chance I didn't have. I ain't going to burden her with that piano. Thank you.
Wow. Well, very good. Thank you. You know, I'm watching you. We've never done anything like this quite like this on the show. Where do you go? What are you thinking about? What do you see when you're reading that?
That monologue in particular, it's just this one part she was talking about. The piano, I think about my father's leg because before my father died, he had a prosthetic leg. And I always think about someone taking that leg out of my house or just out of my life, and it brings me to an emotional state. So that, like, I have a personal connection with that monologue.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. And we're going to carry this over after the news, just to be fair to you. But when are the finals in May, Derek?
May 5th in New York.
May 5th in New York?
Yeah, and Monday, May 5th.
And how many people are competing? And
I think there are over 20 from six different cities.
20.
I think there are 20.
So that's,
I think there are 20.
So you guys really made
eight different cities. Sorry, 8 different cities? 16. So it'll be 16.
So you made a good cut. I mean, that's
yeah,
a small...
Yeah.
What do the winners get?
They get a scholarship. They get a $1,000 scholarship. The Chicago winners get a $500 scholarship. They get a scholarship to UIC to go to there. And they get an all-expense-paid trip to New York to perform their monologues. If they win in New York, they get much more money.
That's great. Do you guys all want to follow theater as a career? I mean,
yes,
what do you want to do after this?
Yes,
all of you. I want to set you up for after the news. But Booker, what do you?
Okay. Yes, I would like to do theater, but also I would like to create films, and just get more of a positive image like August Wilson did of African Americans. Mm-hmm.
What does your peer group say? I mean, do they ask questions about August Wilson? How does the name, I mean, even in my group, I mean, you know, how does the name resonate and stuff?
Actually, me personally, I didn't know much about August Wilson before I joined drama class my junior year last year. And, you know, from that point, just like reading, we read Fences. That was our first reading in class. And from that point, I just, you know, researched him, took time to research him, and find out, like, who this man was and, like, what his impact was on African-American culture. And for most of my peers, I try to inform them because he was, like, I mean, I know this might be a weird, like, analogy, but, you know, Shakespeare, like, his work was very poetic. Mm-hmm. And it told stories in, like, you know, as you were saying, cadences. Mm-hmm. It told stories in song, music, and our life, our struggles.
Yeah, same question. What do people ask about August Wilson, your friends and family and stuff?
Well, it's, you know,
Casey.
Some of my friends at school, you know, when I told them I was doing this August Wilson, you know, competition, they, you know, depending on who I was talking to, they might not have, you know, known who it was. But anyone afterwards who has seen the monologue or heard it, you know, all of a sudden the questions start to show up. You know, it's like, you know, what's the play about? You know, I've had to explain, like, what the play is about, and just seeing, like, people's reactions. They haven't even seen it, they haven't read it, but just like hearing, like, what it was about, they're like, oh my god, that sounds awesome. Like, that's like, you know, and it's just like, I don't know, you know, you've done a good job if even, like, you know, long after you're gone, people are still like, you know, this is really powerful.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to hang around. Just, we'll do one little thing after the news, so don't go away. We'll be back with more August Wilson competition winners after the news. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, and we're here with the winners of the August Wilson Monologue Competition. Derek Sanders, Executive Director of the Chicago August Wilson Monologue Competition. Students Lauren Carter, Casey Edwards, and Booker Vance from Chatham. And tell us what you're going to read here and why you picked it.
I will be reading a monologue.
This is Booker. Yeah.
Yes. Booker Vance, I will be reading a monologue from the play Two Trains Running by a character named Memphis. And basically, it was a funny story. So me and my barber acts too. So we trade, like, monologues and stuff. And I heard him say a snippet of it. And, you know, the first line, you know, that's where the problem is. And then it stuck with me. So when we had to choose this year, I was thinking, you know, that monologue kind of resonated and the message. So I read through the whole thing and I felt like, you know, it was something that I had to do. So, like, I read this story, and basically Two Trains Running is a story about how African-Americans they have different perspectives on, you know, their struggles and basically, you know, the social aspect and also, like, societal aspect of how, you know, we are, and Memphis actually, he owns a restaurant, and basically this is in the Hill District, and basically Memphis's restaurant is, people want him to sell his restaurant, and he refuses for the cost that they're putting up. Mm-hmm. So he's struggling with maintaining his integrity during, you know, these circumstances.
Okay. Go ahead.
That's what half the problem is. These black power Negroes, they got people confused. They don't know what they're doing themselves. These Negroes talking about freedom, justice, and equality, and don't know what it means. You born free. It's up to you to maintain it. You born with dignity and everything else. These Negroes talking about freedom, but what you gonna do with it? Freedom is heavy. You gotta put your shoulder to freedom. Put your shoulder to it and hope your back hold up. And if you round here looking for justice, you got a long wait. Ain't no justice. That's why they got that statue of her, got her blindfolded. Common sense would tell you, if anybody needs to see, she do. There ain't no justice. Jesus Christ didn't get justice. What makes you think you gonna get it? That's just the nature of the world. These Negroes talking about they want freedom, justice, and equality. Equal to what? Hell, I might be a better man than you. What I look like going around here talking about I want to be equal to you? I don't know how these Negroes think sometimes. Talking about black power. With their hands and their pockets empty. You can't do nothing without a gun. Not in this day and time. That's the only kind of power the white man understand. They think they gonna talk their way up on it. In order to talk your way, you got to have something under the table. These Negroes don't understand that. If I tell you to get out my yard and leave my apples alone, I can't talk you out. You sit up in a tree and laugh at me. But if you know I might come out with a shotgun, that'd be something different. You'd have to think twice about whether you wanted some apples. These Negroes around here talking about black is beautiful. Sounds like they're trying to convince themselves. You got to think you ugly to run around shouting you're beautiful. You don't hear me say that. Hell, I know I look nice. Got good manners and everything. Thank you.
Wow. When was that? Do you know when that was written?
1969. It was said during the 60s, but I'm not sure.
Okay, that the reason I asked that, it's 2015. Yeah. What do you think about that?
I believe that the message still resonates, I mean, in different, like, contexts, because it's not necessarily the Black Power movement, but it's things that are, like, going on and people around and people struggling with, you know, self-worth and integrity. Mm-hmm. So just knowing that, I believe his message is still very relevant to today.
Tremendous. Thank you. Thanks, you guys. Thank you. This is really, thank you so much for coming in. And I really wish you the best of luck in New York. And let's stay in touch. I want to know how it goes.
Absolutely.
Okay? All right. Thank you. That's the Chicago August Wilson Monologue Competition winners. Once again, Derek Sanders, Lauren Carter from Bronzeville, Casey Edwards from Hyde Park, Booker Vance from Chatham. Thank you very much for coming down here tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. And we're going to work on, we're not too good on segues here. Our next guest, I've never done this. Our next guest is, luckily, he's one of my dearest friends, Angelo Varius.
You're so showbiz.
And reason Ange is here tonight, it's Record Store Day. It's all over now. But there's a John Prine, I'm sure it's sold out. John Prine, September 78. Tell us about that. You were on that record, recorded at the Park West.
Yeah, it was a record where the guys in the band, I should probably name them,
yeah.
John Burns and played guitar, and Tom Pekarski was the bass player. Howard Levy played everything, keyboards, harmonica, all kinds of instruments, and I played drums. And we sort of got together in during the Steve Goodman tour that we were doing in 77 called the Rolling Blunder Review. We did like a Midwestern tour.
I saw that at Pfeiffer Hall.
Yeah,
in
that's
Naperville.
What we met. Yeah. We met during that tour. It was Love at First Sight, I think, between you and me. But Tom was the only person who wasn't on that tour. But That's where we met, and John was sort of in a little fallow period. He just got done recording with Atlanta Records, which is primarily sort of like a R&B and soul label, and so I don't think they really knew what to do with him. I mean, the records he made were great, but I just didn't think they had an idea of how to promote him correctly. So he was waiting for the next contract from a major label, which was Electro Asylum, but he was having a difficult time sort of getting that record done. And Steve Goodman jumped in, recorded the record. It was called Bruised Orange. It's a fabulous record, great writing, and Steve made a real pristine record, and it was really something Electro Asylum could promote and push. And I think John was going to take... the guys who did a lot of the record, the studio guys from Chicago, out on tour, but they all wanted exorbitant amounts of money because they knew it was going to be a big tour, it was going to go on forever and ever. And John just said, nah. He decided to take local guys, some Chicago guys, and sort of build the band from that. And that's how we all got together. And we started out touring about four or five preliminary dates, and then we hit L.A., and we got great reviews. The first live shows we did, everybody in the industry was there. It was like crazy. People were screaming. Robert Hilburn from LA Times wrote a great review about how great everything was. John was very excited about it. I mean, I had like sitting at a table after the show, I had Chris Christopherson on one side of me and Phil Spector at the other asking me about how the band was going. I was like, you know, my head was spinning. We were all basically Chicago guys who'd never done a big, big tour before. So we sort of clung together. And from that moment on, it was about 4 or 5 months later that we got to the Park West and did this record, which was just released today for Record Store Day, called September 78. My son got a copy in Cincinnati. I texted him and he said, yeah, you got one there. And I know my oldest daughter was at a couple of places this morning.
She was at our show sponsor, Dusty Groove. I saw on Facebook, 5:45. She said, with all the other dorks.
I know, all the record store dorks. But for the people that don't know, this is a big day. This is like the people that like vinyl and like LPs. This was a real big day. So it's exciting that John hit a record that came out.
And it's on Orange Vinyl, too.
On Orange Vinyl.
Yeah. You know, what we forget about, and it's kind of some of the projects I'm working on now, we're talking about 78, 79, you and I were talking. I mean, there was the punk movement, there was Roots Revival, there was also disco, you know. I mean, what was it like to be in the middle or in that atmosphere?
It was really, it was like a fermenting time, and... you know, the early 70s was all those big arena rock bands with huge hair, and they were, you know, it's like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Drummers are spinning around, and everything was bigger and bigger because after the 60s, you didn't know what to do. So people just got bigger and broader and more advanced in how they tried to do their stage setup. And then with disco, early 70s and mid 70s was sort of a time of fantasy. It wasn't real. And then there was just a need for more reality in the music, and the punk music that came out, came out of England and came out of the States was a reaction. People started looking back at the roots. There were rockabilly things that started happening. People were looking at how music started. People started recording lo-fi again. They were through with the like 64 tracks to try to make a record. It was a real interesting time to see people pointing fingers and saying, this isn't real music. Let's make some real music. And for us to be on the road and playing with a guy as phenomenal as John Prine, as a songwriter who is as revered nationally as anybody that ever came out of Chicago, was quite an experience.
And you said, I mean, the band had been together like 5 months by the time you got to Park
West?
Yeah,
about 5 months. We'd rehearsed for about 3 or 4 weeks, and then we hit the road in late May, and then we just nonstop from that time through. So by the time we got to September, we were cooking like crazy. I mean, we had become a band. John had become a band leader. I listened to the record, and the tempos are a little quicker. The precision, the playing off each other's a little bit different. I mean, from how I remembered it back in the old days, because, you know, my memory now is fading as I get old. But it was a real interesting time. And I think that record, it just really captures that moment in time. And it's really exciting. And the things I picked up when I listened to the record was that there's a lot of Chicago feel in the music. I mean, there's a track, I don't know if we're going to play that one or not, but it, to me, it sounds like the Butterfield Blues Band playing. I mean, there was that feel. There was a little bit of country. There was a rockabilly thing going on. We did an Elvis song. There was a little New Orleans in there. I mean, we did.
You did Treat Me Nice, Elvis, right?
There's another track we did that had like a New Orleans sort of sloppy, swampy rock thing in there. So, I mean, we really got the roots down, and it was very exciting to do.
I've known you forever. You've always been.
Forever Day.
You've always been so modest about that, but who all did you drum with? I mean, besides John. I mean, Jethro Burns, right? You did a record with him?
I did, I did a record with him. I did, went down to Nashville and did some session stuff with some bluegrass guys, Jesse McReynolds, Vassar Clements, those people, Conway Twitty.
You were a Twitty bird.
I was a Twitty bird. Yeah, yeah, it's pretty scary to say. In fact, I explain it to people, they have no idea what I'm talking about. And then, you know, I played with Pat McLaughlin, who's another great songwriter, and Jerry Jeff Walker I played with Jerry Jeff for a little bit.
Okay, now we're going to set up this track. This is the first track on the first side.
You sound like a train conductor. Yeah, yeah. Let's set up the track. Yeah.
And it's often is a word I seldom use.
Yes.
And we picked that, and you kind of explained why you like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we're good to go. Often is a word I seldom use.
I know that you're lonely, you're lying with me as well. Want you to know that I'm lately howling, call I may not get the trouble. Well, I'm cold and tired and I can't stop calling. I don't have to tell you all the things I like to tell you. I'll see you go often. Often is a word I say all of. Often is a word I say all of.
You can go for
watching me 11 and slapping my back. How'd you like to die in a half a beers with nobody around to close your eyes? I'm cold and I'm tired and I can't stop talking long enough to tell you all the things I'd like to tell you. And I'll see you go off. Often is a word I tell you. Often is a word I tell you.
Often is a weird, Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. We're here with my good friend, drummer Angelo Varius of the John Prine Band and the Famous Potatoes. And tell me about the Go Cubs Go session. It's a great story.
Well, I was invited in by Steve Goodman, and there was like everybody in Chicago who was a musician was invited in. Were you there? I don't know.
You know, I was at Suburban Sun-Times filing a story, so I couldn't make it. I think they wanted me for hand claps or something.
Right. So there was everybody in the studio. Steve had written this song and been asked by WGN to do this song. And I got a chance to participate. In fact, Steve threw money at people all the time. I mean, he even invited me back to do overdubs with a tambourine, something they'd never even used, but just so I could get an extra check. So I still have that check
from
Chicago Cubs for $100 for overdubs. So I'm happy to have that. But, you know, I don't understand the Mark Caro of the Tribune has got this vendetta about Go Cubs Go. I mean, I don't know if it was an editor or it's his idea, but why would you possibly go after that song? I mean, Steve Goodman is our municipal treasure. And he wrote a song that is, you know, it's got a Bo Diddley beat. It's got, you know, like a gospel feel. He sings like Buddy Holly on it. I mean, it is not an advertising jingle. It is not.
That's what these other ones sound like.
Every other city, if you go to 30 other major league towns, you hear these very stupid songs that sound like they just came out of an advertising agency's jingle. And we have the only true authentic song, and for some reason he wants to get it out of here because it's 20 years old. Take Me Out to the Ball Game's 100 years old. Should we get rid of that, too? I don't understand, you know.
I'm happy to report I saw my first Cub win today, and they did play it at the end of the game.
I saw that, and people were jumping up and singing it and screaming. I mean, it's, you know, it's an anthem. So I just think they should leave it alone and let the legacy of that song continue on.
I totally agree with you. Where was it recorded at?
It was at Hank Neubauer's place, Chicago Recording.
John McDonough, all kinds of people were in the studio.
John McDonough was like, all he did was he had earphones on, and the whole time he's going, Steve Goodman. And we didn't know who he was. I mean, it was all like Chicago folk guys sitting around singing Go Cubs Go, and he's, you know, he's doing that. John Burns' guitar solo, which I think everybody in the city can whistle and knows. I mean, they know it more than they know, like, Stairway to Heaven. I mean, it is that in our it's in our DNA. And so just leave it alone. Mark Caro in the Tribune, leave it alone.
Great. Thanks. Okay. Thanks. Thanks so much for coming in. You're a great friend. Thanks for your support this week. You've been fantastic.
Absolutely.
And Angelo Varius, and you're on September 1978, the John Prine Live at the Park West.
Thanks, Dave.
Okay, thank you. We'll be back with Daniel Garzina's Off the Eaten Path after the news.
Give us a bottle of your finest champagne, 5 shrimp cocktails, and some bread for my brother.
We have a Dom Perignon 71 at $120.
That'll be fine, pal.
A bottle of white, a bottle of red.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, and we're here with Daniel Garzina and Off the Eaten Path. I love Billy Joel. He's having a kid.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing.
65, he's my hero. He's a 33-year-old wife or something.
It's amazing. He never quits, that guy.
He's the piano man.
Is he playing at Wrigley again this year? I don't know.
I guess. I don't know. I had to review him once, but that was enough. That was enough.
Yeah.
So what's new on the food beat, young Daniel?
Oh, man. Well, the major news this week is probably the saddest, toughest story I've ever had to cover.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Just the nature of it, the tragic death of Chef Olamar Cantu of Motor Restaurant, most well known for. It's really tragic. You know, he was probably the most experimental chef like I've ever seen. Him and Grant Achatz of our time, and probably, you know, in the entire world has ever seen.
The entire world.
Yeah, he did stuff that chefs, some chefs around the world, have never done. Involving science, involving using new scientific tools in the kitchen. That was almost like a lab as much as it was a restaurant. Mm-hmm. He was always bursting with ideas every time I talked to and saw him. It was just one thing after another. Many things that were meant to really help people. His work with the miracle berry, which was probably most well known for, which is a West African fruit, which when eaten and ingested before you eat, it turns sweet taste sour. So he thought he could eliminate sugar from foods. And one of the best stories I have about that was when he would send me emails that cancer patients would send him, and saying that, like, they made their last days, his food and these things made their last days tolerable because of the chemo that they were on. Everything tasted metallic and they couldn't taste food anymore. And that was just that story is just probably the best story that I have just personally with him. I saw many of these things. It was amazing work.
How much I read a New York Times story today, actually, with Paul, and I do know Paul Kahan, about man, what a stressful occupation we have. He talked about all the stress these right. chefs have, and you know, I think stress is the waitress at the Golden Apple pulling two shifts. I mean, those guys.
Right.
Paul has it pretty good. But how much in the world of celebrity chefs and stuff? How much of that do they bring on themselves, and how hard is it really to maintain this high profile?
Right. Well, first of all, I will say that like. Anybody who works in the restaurant industry is very high stress.
Yeah.
No matter what position it is, but especially when you're ahead and you're famous and you're overseeing so many people in so many restaurants and so well known and so many customers love you or at least very interested in what you're doing. That is extremely stressful. I know you saw there was a Tribune story where Mindy Siegel was talking about how she contemplated these things. And it's extremely stressful for these people. Omar was a person who was really very outgoing and very cheerful, and so you didn't always know what was going on, and you probably wouldn't have expected this would happen. But it's extremely high stress for these major chefs and restaurateurs.
38 years old, right?
Right. Yeah, 38. Very young.
Restaurants. One reopened tonight, right?
Right. Yeah. One reopened tonight. With the chef, his chef de cuisine, who was running the kitchen, was about to leave. He came back to help, and some of the more famous, prominent alumni that he had underneath him have come back to help it to reopen it for now.
Okay. So, what else? What else is my world of segues?
Yeah. Good job on that one.
Yeah.
The James Beard news. That's huge. The first awards here in Chicago. That's coming up in about 2 weeks. 2 weeks from Monday. And it was just announced that it's coming back for two more years. So it's the first time it's ever been outside of New York this year in Chicago. It's going to be back for two more years, too. So that's a huge get for the city, for ROM. And, you know, the tourism that's going to bring in, the money that's going to bring in, and just the visibility of the restaurateurs. People are getting ready for it now in 2 weeks. It's going to be swamped with major chefs and restaurateurs from around
when does
country.
It start?
The awards are May 4th.
May 4th.
2 weeks from Monday.
And do people come in town for a long period of time, or
yeah.
just the 4th, or how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. People will probably be here at least through the weekend. I'm getting all sorts of invites to all sorts of parties and special events. It's going to be pretty much a madhouse around here, which is about the same time, actually, the NFL draft is here. So that's going to be a crazy time in a lot of ways in Chicago.
So what's a good party? What are a couple good parties?
I don't know if I should really go into
that.
Oh,
come on, Dan. We're all friends.
I will say that it's also Alinea Grand. And Ackett's 10-year anniversary around that time too, so they're going to be doing some big things around that time too. But there's just, you know, honestly, mostly it's in New York, so I haven't experienced it that much. But the stories that I hear and the stories that I read and people I know in the industry that tell me about things that have happened in New York, it's going to be, if it's anything like that, it's going to be crazy.
Okay. And Burger Week?
Yeah. So we had a. We do themed weeks once a quarter or so, and this one was all about...
We being...
Our Eater, all of the Eater Network. So I run Eater Chicago. So
right.
we do a lot of stories about burgers, Roundup's best burgers this, burgers by neighborhood. I interviewed a long-time waitress at RJ Grunts, which was...
Oh, that's a great place.
Interesting. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
she's been around since 1980. She's been working there. So that was fascinating. It's really amazing to me about burgers is that this is something that's been around for so long. This is not a new dish, you know. And I feel like the popularity of the hamburger right now is maybe at its peak that it's ever been. And it's in Chicago specifically, it's interesting because a lot of people think of like the hot dog stand, which go hand in hand with burgers, these kind of little hole-in-the-wall places all around the city. And it's amazing how it's graduated from from these small hot dog stands and burger stands to, you know, major chefs putting, doing amazing, you know, innovative things with hamburgers on their menus at, you know, very prominent restaurants all around the country, really, but here in Chicago for sure.
Why do you think the burger is so hot right now?
I don't know. I think there's a nostalgic aspect to it for
there
one.
Is.
People, it brings them back. It brings people back to the childhood. This is something that, you know, after you go to, you know, you have a little league game with your parents and they're like, okay, good job. Let's go get a burger. Let's go get a ice cream. It's one of those things that people just love. And it's also just, I know people that are vegetarian who the one thing that they crave is a hamburger. You know, the hamburger is just something about the taste and the way it's done and the nostalgia, like all in one. It's also amazing to me because, you know, people are very, this time in food, people are probably the most health conscious as they've ever been. But the one thing that endures, the most endures through that is the hamburger. And for all those factors, it's just the thing that just people love, you know.
Can you give the listeners some tips on good burgers in Chicago, the Chicago area?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a few that are just real foodies. I don't like to use that word, but they know really much about Kuma's Corner, absolutely, which is did kind of, you know, these fat burgers, but innovative takes on it in this, you know, metal bar.
Yeah.
That's but the burgers there are fantastic, and it's a thick burger, which is the trend now is for like thin griddled, like kind of old school patties with just like American cheese. Kuma's does amazing things with the thick patty, all sorts of, you know, crazy kinds of toppings, and burger of the month is amazing every time. Au Cheval was named the best hamburger in the world by Bon Appetit 2 years ago. There's always a line out the door over there in the West Loop, Randolph and Halstead.
How much does that cost?
The burger is actually not that much. Off the top of my head, I think it's 10 or 12.
Okay.
Most people don't know, but a lot of people don't know about it because the burger gets so much publicity. But the other dishes, it's kind of like a hipster kind of diner thing. But the other dishes, they're amazing too. But the hamburger is well known. I think I love Edzo's, which is like a smaller kind of fast casual shop that's up in Evanston. They used to have one in Lincoln Park that sadly closed a couple months ago. That's an amazing kind of a thin griddle burger smashed. Those are my top three.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming in. You know, next time you come in, we got to open up the phone lines and take some calls.
Yeah, we could have done with burgers.
That'd
be perfect,
actually. We'll do that. We got to get our phone number out there. I don't even know what it is. But thank you, Daniel, for coming in. We're going to take a break for some commercials. We're going to talk about the 18th Annual Chicago Improv Festival after this. Cue me in on some of those parties, Dan.
Okay.
All right. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. That's kind of a cocktail lounge thing there going on. We're here with people from the 18th Annual Chicago Improv Festival. That's Mary Mahoney on keys there, musical director for Second City. We have Jonathan Pitts, co-founder, executive producer of the festival.
That's right? Very, very true.
Very good. Christina
Guzikova.
Russian?
Yes.
Okay. Привет. Yeah. Because we're going to get to world comedy here. Stephen Lyons from New Zealand and Victor Soares from Improv Brazil.
Yeah. Right.
So tell us about, Jonathan, tell us about just the background of the festival and how it all got started and kind of zero in on this world angle.
Well, 18 years ago, I was working on a lot of other festivals. I was the theater curator for the Around the Coyote. I also produced. I was the coordinator for the Bailiwicks Director Festival, and I worked on a children's festival called Magic City, and I worked with a woman named Frances Callier, and working all these different festivals, one day it occurred to me, I'm like, how come Chicago has never had a festival? Because it didn't at that time. It never had an improv festival 18 years ago up to that point. In fact, 18, 20 years ago, the biggest improv festival in America was in Austin, Texas, which is really just kind of weird that it was there and not here because Chicago is the birthplace and the mecca of modern improvisation. So I said Chicago should have its own festival. And I first got turned on by festivals because I worked for the Old International Theater Festival, which was Jane Solins, Bernie's wife. She had created the International Theater Festival of Chicago, ran for 10 years, and I was a production intern on it in 1990, That was the year they had Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson. And I just got blown away by seeing how theater is done all over the world. And it was really exciting as a theater artist to see how much I had in common with other theater artists in other countries, regardless of whether or not we shared the same language. We shared the same passion for what makes great theater, and I saw that there were so many different ways to make theater. So once I created the Chicago Improv Festival, it was really important to me that every year we have some sort of international component. Our first year it was small, so it was just some people from Canada, but that was something.
Yeah.
And then it's grown over time, and over time we've added on more and more countries. In the 18 years that we've done it, we've had groups from 24 countries perform here. And not all at the same time, of course, but that's very exciting. Last year we had 10 countries. This year we have performers from 10 countries. And everybody here has actually been in performed in the festival before from their various countries. And that to me is really important because to me, to play is universal. It's part of a universal humanity. We all share the joy of playing, whether or not. Yeah, so that's why it's great to be able to have people from other countries come and improvise, share, and even if they improvise another language, just really sparks this joyful feeling, seeing the playfulness that comes from all over the cultures, different countries, even if you don't understand the language when it's a New Zealander speaking.
Now, the festival starts, the festival runs from when to when, Jonathan?
The festival runs October, that's my birthday.
One track mind.
Yeah, yeah. The festival goes April 20th through the 26th. It starts on Monday, runs for a week. In that time period, we have 152 groups, 761 improvisers performing in 14 theaters on 21 stages over 1 week. We're the world's largest improv festival, and since it's the mecca of it, it's nice to have that title here. So it's no longer in Austin.
One World, One Stage is what I'm going to talk about, and that's April 22nd, 8 o'clock at Comedy Sports, 929 West.
Actually, it's at 7.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it's at 7.
Okay, anyway, Comedy Sports,
yes,
929
that's true.
West Belmont.
Yep.
And will all you be there?
Yes.
Okay, tell me what will happen.
Oh, wow.
Christina.
You put it on the spot.
Yeah.
We will improvise. For the past few years when we've done this, it was fascinating that you will improvise with people you never seen, and I never seen them after. So it's like one night stand comedy.
It's also kind of...
I know about that.
I mean, it's there's what the show structure is that each of the groups is going to get 10 minutes, so they're going to get up there. You get to see a bit of their style, because the wonderful thing about this is Chicago is amazing, but we're so big that we're almost just happy being us in Chicago. And it's so wonderful to see international people come over and be like, you know what, our whole forum is 10 minutes. We're just going to hang out with this cabbage on stage, and you'd be so surprised where you're like, oh, these guys made this amazing story just about a cabbage. And so each group's going to have 10 minutes to kind of get a taster for them. And then you can find their full-length shows later in the festival. And then after that, you get a chance to see all of them jam together, which is that one-night stand where, you know, these are people who live literally, you know, like 24 hours travel away from each other, and they might never step back on stage together again. And it's an amazing energy and support and love. All of these people have traveled so far, and they bring such joy and passion to what they do.
And it's very interesting to see, like, how everybody from different countries, different styles, different cultures can make, like, a scene together, and everything gets together and create a new story. So it's fun to see, like, everybody have a different style, have a different culture, like, have a different story, and everybody, everything gets together to one story in the end.
So let's go around the room. What's the Brazilian style?
I don't know if we have, like, a style. I think there's more physical. We create more characters. We go to the physical form. We create, like, more more places. Like, I think it's more physical. Like, I can compare, like, the clown. Okay. Can be, like, a clowny, improvise. But, of course, we create, like, we follow the hero's journey. Like, it's the basic for improv. But I think the difference, not the difference, but basically is that. My English is not too good to explain that.
Neither is mine.
And mine's awful as well.
That's the problem.
Yeah. we're gonna take a break for some. Oh, we're gonna take a break for the news, and we'll be back with more Improv Festival after this.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Very good. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, and we're here talking about the 18th Annual Chicago Improv Festival, specifically World Comedy, One World, One Stage, April 22nd. Before we get in a little bit here, tell me about the difference. We were talking about different styles before the break between like Russian and New Zealand styles. Are there, is that just my imagination? Are they very distinct styles?
I think every country has its own, you know, it's like a recipe, is every country has its own things that we heighten, things that we like. It's so dependent on what your culture is like. And it's also, it's hard for us because some of us will come from set theaters where, like, this is the style that our theater does. And that may not be indicative of, you know, like, all of New Zealand. I can't go, hey, I speak for, you know, all 300 people in New Zealand. But... my theater style is we're very playful, narrative. We love physicality. We're very connective in the style of theater that my group, the Improv Bandits, performs. However, that might be different in the Ukraine.
It is absolutely different. Well, actually, I'm representing Russia today.
politics. Russia.
Yeah. You have a lot of Putin material? Well,
can I bear
it? Well, my team was actually very, like... we would talk a lot, and we would just stand and not move and just talk, and we would make jokes. But after we've been invited to International Improv Festival, we realized that it would be harder for us to talk in English. It's our second language. We have to think first, then translate, and it would take time that our other teams would be, like, waiting for us, you know, while we come up with something funny, right? So we became more physical after, like, moving to second language, which is English.
Where does Jerry Lewis rate with all you guys?
On a VHS in my mom's cabinet somewhere. You
know, Daryl and I are big Jerry Lewis fans. But has France ever been involved in this?
No.
Yeah.
That's the reason why.
Yeah, right. That's it. So we're going to do a little, we're going to try a little bit here, right? We're going to do a little radio improv.
Yep.
Remember, we're on radio, so we can't get too physical. So
Nothing can go wrong.
What are we going to do next?
They are going to sing a lullaby. They're going to improvise a lullaby. Mary's going to play music for it, and the three of them are going to sing. Two of them are going to sing in their natural language. Well, actually, all three will.
Yeah, I'll sing in New Zealand.
Really? Okay. All right.
Sorry about that. Try to do native New Zealand.
That would only guarantee to be offensive.
So they're going to sing a lullaby, and in order for them to get started, do you want a theme or just a word? What do you want?
We're gonna, what's something that confuses you?
Radio.
All right, now a lullaby.
Radio. And radio?
Yeah.
Never turn off your radio. 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 Never turn,
never turn
off your radio.
Radio.
Never turn off your radio.
Эта ночь все ушли спать опять. Украина не Россия. Путин спать. Путин спать.
Never turn off your radio. Never turn off your radio.
Never
turn off your radio. Never turn off your radio.
É tão bom estar no rádio. Onde eu não posso falar palavrão,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mas se eu falar, ninguém vai gostar.
Vai gostar.
Vou acabar preso e vão me estuprar.
I love Portuguese.
Never turn off your radio. Never turn off your radio. Never turn off your radio. Never turn off your radio.
Very good. Very good. We got a new spot here for the show. Thank you. Thank you. Mary, how long have you been with Second City?
About 2 years.
About 2 years? Mm-hmm. So you like, you do a lot of lullaby time? I mean, you like locked right into that and all took off. I mean.
Yeah, when I feel like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. A couple other quick things. Daryl, you came all the way down here. Your new father. Talk about Jason Chin and the Jason Chin tribute.
Yeah, I understand there's going to be a night devoted to Jason Chin. He was a wonderful improv director, performer, producer. He was on the scene for several decades here, really. I met him when he was directing a Star Wars musical in the 90s that George Lucas ended up shutting down, but it was a wonderful show anyway. He passed away in January prematurely. He was a young man still in his 40s and had a dark sense of humor, and so when they had a memorial service for him a few days later, the improvisers got up and started giving memorial speeches about him, and before long it turned into a roast. People saying vicious things about the deceased that were hilarious and completely appropriate for the mindset of Jason Chin. So he's gonna be very worthy of a tribute here.
And by the way, this I neglected to say, it's Daryl Jevons, entertainment editor of the Chicago Sun-Times. What will happen at the event?
We are going to be giving him posthumously a CIF Lifetime Achievement Award. And two of his best friends are going to receive it on behalf of his mother, and they will take the award. And then when she comes in June to help scatter his ashes, she will take the award and take it back home. After the award, there's going to be a speech that's going to be read that Jason's mom has written. And then we're going to have three performances by probably the most three well-known groups that groups and shows that Jason had put together that were improvised, as opposed to the Star Wars thing, which was quasi-improvised. So World News Tonight is going to perform, 3033 is going to perform, and Jeff Griggs is going to remount Dinner for Six with all new improvisers, which is appropriate because Jason really was like the Statue of Liberty. He always took people that had just gotten started and gave them time on stage and gave them places to perform. You know, he was not as he gave room for everybody in the beginning, which made him a better person than me in a lot of ways, because I'm interested in the people once they've arrived, once they've gotten excellent, and he didn't have that filter. He wanted everyone to get in and have a chance to perform and to do well. And so he touched so many lives as a teacher and a director and a performer, because he made room for everybody and he made everybody feel welcome and he accepted everybody. And so all the tickets that are being raised that night is going to go to a Jason Chin scholarship fund to help future improvisers who don't have money so that they can take improv classes. And we're not taking a penny of it. It's all just going to go to the scholarship. We give away lifetime achievement awards. Like, you know, Sheldon Patinkin died earlier mm-hmm. this year. We'd already given one to him. We give away a lot of lifetime achievement awards. This is the youngest person we've ever had to give a lifetime achievement award. But, you know, if he started doing improv when he was 22 and he did it till he's 46, that was his lifetime and that was his passion. So he's worthy of it.
And where can people find out? How many different venues do you have this at, and where can people go for more information?
14 different venues, but if you want to know where to go, easiest thing to do is go to chicagoimprovfestival.org. Everything that you want to find is on there. Because we have so many groups, we broke the festival down into 8 different artistic categories so people can go see what they want to go see. Like if you like musical improv, like what you heard tonight, you can just click on the music section, and we have really great shows that will be happening all weekend long. It's chicagoimprovfestival.org. Everything that's we're doing is up there on that website.
I brought in my friend Sergio Mayora and
Marco Romero.
Marco, and the reason you're here, you do Mexican-American comedy.
Well, I kind of do, you know, that type of, I guess, comedic family-type stuff with Mexicans in it. Okay. My family's a bunch of, you know, Mexicans.
Yeah. That makes sense. And you're going to an event. Sergio, tell us about your event on April 25th.
April 25th,
2005, South Blue Island. It's in Chicago.
The greatest art show in the world.
Yeah, it's the birth of a new phase. Enter Paradise. The gallery is called Catalina. Two comedians, two disc jockeys.
John Sinclair.
John Sinclair, one of the poets, about 8-10 poets, 35 artists, and that's about it.
Who are you honoring, Serge?
I'm honoring Marla Donato, former Tribune. I'm honoring Tony Fitzpatrick, a great, great, great artist. I'm honoring Susan Craig, who runs the Outsider Art.
Intuit. Yeah.
And who's that guy? Dave Hoekstra. Yeah. That's right.
What have you learned? I mean, did anything you hear tonight resonate with you?
I liked it. It's very cool. I like that that world comedian thing going on there.
Yeah, we do have a group coming in from Mexico City. Yeah. They're just not here yet.
Actually, my parents live in Mexico City. Cool. So you've got something in common there.
Yeah, there's one group down there called Impro Top. And then we have another group coming in from Mexico that's going to be playing. But they'll be arriving like Sunday night.
How many countries overall did you say?
Ten
countries represented.
And I'm going to have 7 Romanians staying with me at my apartment.
No.
Awesome. Yes.
Really?
Yeah. It's a 3-bedroom apartment in Wicker Park. I got a lot of air mattresses.
So, Marco, when you talk, I mean, you're born in Chicago.
I was born out here. I was actually born in the suburbs. You know, basically, my comedic stuff is family. I got family. Tomorrow morning when I make breakfast with my kids, there's a whole thing right there. I mean, the other day I told my little girl, you know, she goes, "Daddy, I want to have a boyfriend when I get older." I go, "Sweetie, you can't have a boyfriend. If you have a boyfriend, you're going to make his mom cry." She goes, "Daddy, why is his mom going to cry?" "Well, because Daddy got to cut all his fingers off, dig a hole, and put him in it." "Daddy, that's terrible." "Okay, I don't want to have a boyfriend." Weeks go by. She goes to the sitter's house. Get a call from my wife. What'd you tell her daughter about her boyfriend?" I go, "I don't know. What did I say?" So I guess one of the mothers there goes to Jessica and goes, "Sweetie, you're so beautiful. Maybe you and my son can be boyfriend and girlfriend one day." Well, my daughter goes, "No, you don't want to cry." She goes, "Why would I cry, sweetie?" "Because my daddy's going to cut your boy's fingers off and put him in a hole. And you're never going to see him again." That kind of stuff.
Okay.
So,
okay. Other places they can see you? What you guys do stuff outside of the? I mean, as we wrap it up.
So you can see. I perform Stephen Lyons. I perform with Comedy Sports Chicago, Laugh Out Loud in Schaumburg. Both of those doing short form, a lot of fun improv. I've got a Antiques Roadshow with Devin Myers, which is a semi-scripted musical parody of Antiques Roadshow, opening at MCL at the end of the month. Which will be ridiculous and a lot of fun. As well as, of course, you should all make it along to One World, One Stage.
Same thing, Victor?
Yeah, actually, I'm performing in L.A., improv duo with Mike Oichow called Samba Panda. We perform in small theaters in L.A., and basically in this stage is that.
And I perform every day in Evanston, right in front of my 17-year-old son, because he requires a lot of entertainment, so yeah. That's what I do.
Yeah, that's right. And Daryl, where will you be appearing soon?
I will be appearing back at work after paternity leave tomorrow.
Okay. All righty. Well, thank you all for coming down. Thanks for the music, and good luck this week.
Thank you, Dave. Give us the website one more time. ChicagoImprovFestival.org.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll be back after this commercial break. I'd like to thank our world of guests tonight. We went all over the place, and I'd like to thank Dan Long for trying to keep all this together. Thank you, Daniel. We buried our father on Monday. The day began with rain, but by the time we reached the cemetery, the sun was out. The sound of taps echoed across the freshly mowed grass. The military honored my father for his efforts in the Battle of the Bulge, which I told you about here in December. The skies were free. Everything was now within reach. The next day I read about the proposed Wanda Vista Tower, which would become the third highest skyscraper in Chicago. I thought about our dad. You see, when we returned to Chicago in 1967 from Columbus, Ohio, one of the first things Dad did was take me to the top of the Prudential Building on East Randolph Street. Dedicated on December 8, 1955, the original Prudential Building was the first skyscraper to be built in Chicago after the Depression. It had the fastest elevator in the world, moving at 1,400 feet a minute. What a ride! The escalators between the 40th and 41st floor were then at the highest level in the world. My parents used to have lunch at the Stouffer's Top of the Rock restaurant adjacent to the observation deck. With his trademark warmth and humility, my dad showed his 12-year-old son the possibilities of growing up here in Chicago. As a child of the Depression, these were possibilities he did not have. From the Top of the Rock, as it was called, we saw the emerging suburbs, the beauty of Lake Michigan, the ability to reach for the stars. About 20 years ago, I returned to the original Prudential building. Its neighbor to Prudential Plaza was completed in 1990. And longtime chief building engineer told me the Prudential was still the Cadillac of the Loop. It was handsome, dependable, romantic. It was constructed when skyscrapers were new and our dad was young. Forever young. Thanks for listening tonight.
Your dad did.